Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Tonight we're looking at Ecclesiastes chapters 8 and 9. We glanced at 8 for a little bit at the end of last week's class, but tonight we're going to unpack it in clarity. Solomon has been painting a pretty depressing picture that there is no hope, and everything he's touched has not turned to gold, but has turned to folly and sadness. And he says, you know, I tell you what, I'm just going to go out and eat, drink, and be merry. We're going to see that later tonight. Because there's nothing else under the sun. In the natural world, you got to wonder what it is that causes people to be moral. You ask your friends, is it right or wrong that Nelson Mandela had fantastic tributes in his 95th year as he died? They'll say, oh, he was a great guy. They'll say he freed the blacks in South Africa, that he brought justice to people. They'll comment on his international service. They'll comment on any number of things. But Jerry and I were talking before the meeting tonight about Soweto, the suburb, really, near Joburg, where there's still no running water. His home, where there's still poverty beyond anything we've got here in Sydney. And most people will say, well, he tried to fix that, but they'll come up with something to justify him. Look, he wasn't a saint. He did a good thing. In 1990, he was released after how many decades in prison? 27 years. And he was able to do some things. That's great. But there comes an end where you say, justice is not going to happen, where I can't get it all fixed. We're experiencing something right now in Australia where we're evaluating government helping or not helping businesses. A year ago, Ford and Mitsubishi both announced that they were not going to be producing cars in Australia anymore. It simply wasn't financially feasible to maintain a plant and production and get it out in a way that was lucrative for the owners and dividend and shareholders. So yesterday, Holden announced that they were going to be closing shop, and the handwriting's on the wall for Toyota, and maybe bicycle plants, and maybe motorcycle plants, and whatever else is here. And so now the government is being blamed, the current government, which has only been in power for a short time this year, it's being blamed by Labor, the opposition, for not fixing it, even though Labor was silent about not fixing Ford and Mitsubishi a year ago. And here's the problem. They want the opposition, and anybody else wants to use the political situation just now, to gain favor with the electorate. But what they're saying is, government, you ought to have been involved and fixed it. But that's not how capitalism works. Capitalism works when people buy what they want to buy and don't buy what they don't want to buy, and either the manufacturers or the business people or the salespeople, folks have to say, I'm going to not sell those vacuum cleaners, I'm not going to sell those vehicles, I'm not going to sell that clothing because nobody's buying it, I'm going to go do something else. And I don't need, so every brand isn't supposed to always exist forever. Yeah, but I always had Vegemite, and so if we don't have Vegemite, then it's the government's responsibility to keep the Aussie icon. What? Who taught you economics? Who taught you politics? That's not the way it's supposed to work. Well, if Holden goes down, and we could sing the song that ends in, you know, the Holden brand, does that mean Australia goes down? Does that mean there is no Australia? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means Holden. Australia shouldn't own companies. That's the problem. You don't have capitalism if government owns companies. If you want capitalism, then people own companies, and people can make it work or not make it work. So if David Jones, all of a sudden, doesn't make money, well, then they need to figure out how to make money, lay off staff, okay, sell different products, close stores. That's the way capitalism works. It flexes with the market. Our problem is when we think that government is supposed to come in and fix it. It happened with Qantas, and it happens with Telstra, and it happens with any number of things that we identify as Australian things. Now, here's my point, that government is not supposed to fix economics that way. There are regulations government makes. ACCC works hard to ensure that everybody has a fair go in the grocery business. There's a duopoly with Kohl's and Woolies. Okay, so then Aldi wants to sell products, or the local grocer, or the local meat market guy, or the local fruit salesman. They say, it's not fair because the big guys are there. Well, that's how capitalism works. Big guys gained because, well, they just gained. And if you don't want them to win, stop buying their products. Well, but they own... So here's the deal. When government gets involved, all it can do is mess things up. All it can do is say, we're going to be proprietorship. We're going to own these things. Or we're going to tell the owners how to do things. And that's not how free market works. It really has to be allowed to run so that if a company, car company, dies, well, it dies. And another one rises up. Did anybody ever hear of Lexus in 1985? No. Who'd ever heard of Hyundai? Or Honda in 1950. Was there a Honda? Who knew? We didn't know because capitalism allows the new guy to get up and go up against the Ford and the GM. And so let the winner win. In other words, let the free market be free. Let people buy what they want. Don't buy what they don't want. Government should be about protecting people, but not protecting every job of every Australian of all time. When it's a global market, it's got to compete with China and India and everybody else. Where do we get wisdom and where do we get life? These are the questions that have been haunting the king, the Kohelet, the preacher, throughout this book. And I really find that in Australia, we are bouncing against this question over and over again. And death is going to be in chapter 9, and futility, which is what we're dealing with here. Life is unfulfilling in the categories we've assigned to life. And listen to these comments that the writer of Ecclesiastes makes. Verse 1 of chapter 8, who is like the wise man and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. I say, well, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. Don't be in a hurry to leave him. Don't join in an evil matter. He'll do whatever he pleases. Since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. For there's a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. If no one knows what will happen, who can tell him when it will happen? No man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind, or authority over the day of death, and there's no discharge in the time of war, and evil will not deliver those who practice it. All this I've seen and applied my mind to every deed that's been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. Who is like a wise man, he says. Not who is a wise man, but who wants to be a type of person recognized as wise. Who wants to be a sharp fellow? Who wants to be the one, a go-to guy? Tevye the milkman, they would ask me to advise them like Solomon the wise. Who wants to be like that? This phrase is interesting, the peshar davar, the interpretation of a thing. That word's only used once here in the scripture, in the whole scripture, but it is used in some other companion writings in Dead Sea Scrolls they found. So it's an odd word. This idea of finding wisdom and seeking for wisdom, it's just one of the many options that a guy who wants to experience life says, well, I can't find it in money, and I can't find it in being lucrative out in business, and I can't find it with women, and I can't find it with drink. Well, maybe I'll go be wise. I'll go to the academies. I'll learn Kabbalah. Maybe I'll go and study a lot more. I'll get some more diplomas and some more certificates, and I'll get stuff because there I'll be somebody. Because you know the king, he's got authority. You hear the word authority in there over and over again. Yeah, go up against the king, you're an idiot, because the king will do whatever he wants. And no one says to the king, what are you doing? Verse 4. And verse 8, who has authority over the day of death? It seems like the king does. And verse 9, under the sun wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his own hurt. The word authority is used over and over and over again here. Shelet, it is probably very similar to exousia, the Greek for authority. You know the difference between authority and power? A policeman, a wimpy policeman, has authority. Hulk Hogan and big massive wrestlers out there and Anthony Mundine. They've got power. They have no authority. Anthony Mundine walks down the street and says, "Hey, yo, get out of my face." He has no authority to tell me that. He does have power and he could hurt me, okay? A wimpy policeman wearing a uniform holds up his badge and says, "Move along. You better move along." It has no power. He can't hurt you. But he could do, I don't know what it is, but he could arrest me. He could bring in three or four other guys. They could put me in a wagon and off I go to the police station and I'd be in jail. So authority is authorized power, not necessarily latent power, not necessarily physical power. It is recognized by a society. So a policeman stands in front of moving truck and puts his badge up, the truck stops. The truck has all the power, but the authority is in the policeman. Who knows the interpretation of matter? A man's wisdom illumines him. I like that. It illuminates him. It is the word or. It brings light to him and causes, this is an odd phrase, his stern face to beam. The way I read this, va'oz panav, and the strength of his face is enlightened or beaming. But it's not the word for beaming. It is the word shana, meaning to change, disguise, change, pervert, transfer, different. So man's wisdom both illuminates him and makes the strength of his face to change. There's something about a guy who really gets it, who looks like he gets it. If you don't get it, your face really shows that too. Wisdom has a way of giving you a confidence that is titled here, beaming, but to me it means it's changing. Changing from lack of confidence to confidence. From unsure to sure. And it's not sure based on, I'm just sure of it, but it's based on wisdom. And it goes to your face. There are so many Bible verses throughout the text, all old and new, older and newer testaments, where what goes on inside comes out your face. The lamp of the body is the eye. And there's something about what's deep in your kishkas and deep in your heart and deep in your reserve that comes out your face. It's right to do that. And I've seen beautiful people, I mean handsome men and gorgeous women who walked with God, who no longer walk with God, whose faces are not so pretty anymore. And I've seen fairly ordinary people who now walk with God who are gorgeous. Because what's inside comes out, and it causes our stern face to change. Something about that that I like. It illuminates us. It changes the strength of a man's face. That's the way I translated it. Look what happens. You obey authority. You're not dumb. Verse 2. Keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. Because of what oath? Because of your oath. Because you vowed before God. So do what the king says. Do what authority says. This morning, I was sitting in traffic up on the freeway coming into town. And I was not in a hurry. I had plenty of time to get to the post office to get the mail. I had plenty of time to get from there over here to the shop. But all of a sudden, I said, you know, there's an empty lane here, the carpool lane. And I could just sneak over into the carpool. I don't have anybody in the car with me, but I could just, you know, one time, it's not going to kill me. And there's giant traffic jam coming from three lanes down to one from the hills and my area. And then this empty lane. Oh. It looked so good. It looked like you're on a fast, and it was a gorgeous pavlova. I mean, it was just one of those things. And it wouldn't hurt, and I'm just not going to take up much room, and I could just speed along. But all this was in my mind, because I just read this text again this morning and again last night. I thought, well, no, I can't teach on authority and not comply. It'd just be wrong. And hopefully next week I will say the same thing. I'd stay away from breaking the law. If you break the law a time or two, maybe nothing happens. But if you break the law a time or two a day for a week or a month or a year, you now become callous to that law. And you think you are above that law. And therefore, that law doesn't exist, but you are the authority and not the law. So his warning to us is keep the law, keep under the authorities that God established. I mean, we read this in Romans 13, isn't it? That every authority that's established is from God, Romans 13:1. So submit to the authorities, and Peter wrote about that. It's just sensible. Yeshua said, pay your taxes to see whose inscription is on the coin. You know, so give it to the one whose inscription is there. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Just, if you comply, you have more peace. If you don't, then you have to be the authority, and you have to be making it up almost as you go. It's not a comfortable place to be. So life can be unfulfilling, and in its futility, if we break out from the established pattern, if we break away from what God said and do what we want to do, not what He wants us to do. Verse 3 said something interesting to me. Don't be in a hurry to leave Him. Don't join in an evil matter, for He will do whatever He pleases. What does that mean? Don't be in a hurry to leave Him, to leave the king, to leave the authority. Halach is the word, to just go from Him. When do you jump ship? When do you halach away? Don't leave when you're not dismissed. And don't be part of a treasonous uprising. Don't be part of a coup, necessarily, unless you know that's God's wisdom. And that could be. I mean, that's where democracy, which we have, didn't exist biblically. You had monarchies who are not elected, who don't really answer to the people, who didn't really have to. They could just do whatever they wanted to do, and you were caught out if you were just Joe people, Joe person. So don't run away and don't create some hostility against there. Verses 5 and 6, he who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and mishpat. It says procedure. Usually mishpat is judgment. Chok is a statute, mishpat is a judgment. And again, he uses it in the next phrase. There's no word proper, by the way, there. Time and mishpat for every delight, pleasure, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. So I'm getting the idea that we need to have discernment in what we do and what we don't do, at the time we do what we do and the time we shouldn't do what we should do. So it harkens back to Ecclesiastes 3, there's a time for everything. So every time is not a time to rejoice. Every time is not a time to weep. So there's a time for everything. So use seichel, sense, common sense, which isn't common. I was thinking today about common courtesy, which isn't common either. I don't know why we mislabel it. Really, some guy, some hostility between two people right behind me, and I thought, why aren't you just being courteous? There was no reason to be rude to each other, but they were groveling against each other in the midst of a whole group of people, and they weren't going to win anybody's sympathy. So there's a time for everything. And maybe there's a time for grumbling. I don't know much of it, but there's a time for being kind, that's for sure. Verses 10 to 14 sounds like, I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they're soon forgotten in the city where they did thus. That's also this hevel that's been around the whole study. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Because people get away with things, because judgment doesn't happen to the wicked or to the guilty straight away, well, maybe they're going to be given fully to do evil. As I say, if you get away with something a day or two or five or a week or a month, pretty soon you're callous to it. You know what a callous is. You know how you get a callous. You do the same thing over and over again, and you use the same piece of skin, whether it's a guitar, you're digging a ditch or something, or whatever it is, you grow this facade on your skin, isn't it? And it's an extra layer of skin that prevents something. What does it prevent? It prevents feelings. You cannot feel if you're callous. I suppose if you poke through the callous, which is now the noun, not just the adjective, if you poke through it back to the real skin, ouch, you know, it'll really puncture, it'll really hurt, and you can get back to the nerve ending. But generally speaking, a callous prevents feelings. And when we do wrong enough times, and without the judgment coming, then we say, like he did, the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. Even though I know this theology that I'm supposed to believe in fearing God, it seems like these guys get away with it 1,000 times. And they are callous. They don't have any fear of God. Why am I bothering? Why should I do this? Well, all right. He's informed. Listen, he's informed by this truth that he should fear God. He's informed by that. and he writes it down. But you can almost hear him say, yeah, I'm not sure that I believe that. But I guess I do, but I'm not so sure. You can really feel the tension as Solomon writes this, because he's gotten away with it 1,000 times. He's so autobiographical in this text. It's uncanny. He's giving great advice. You know, you can learn from everybody. You can learn what to do and what not to do. And sure enough, I think he's giving a lot of wisdom about things not being fair because retribution doesn't seem to come. So what does he say in verse 15? So I commended pleasure. Because, you know, nothing else matters. There's nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat, to drink, and to be merry. That's where it comes from. That phrase that you heard all your life, that's where it comes from. And this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life which God has given him under the sun. So in your natural life, there's nothing else better but to eat, drink, and be merry. Because the government's not going to help you. Your next door neighbor's not going to help you. All the things you gain are not going to help you. Wisdom's not going to help you. Tell you what, chuck it in. Eat, drink, and be merry. In fact, you don't even have to eat. Just drink and be merry. In fact, you don't even have to drink. Just be merry. Because end of the day, that's all you've got. That's what he's saying. This is one hopeless man who says, laugh it off, drink it off. There's nothing better. Tachat Hashem, under the sun. That's been his phrase to remind us that he's not speaking about an eternal perspective, but only a natural perspective. This is futility. And he takes it up again in chapter 9 with a haunting memory of death. For I have taken all this to my heart and explain it that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man doesn't know whether it'll be love or hatred. Anything awaits him. It's the same for everybody. There's one fate for the righteous and for the wicked. For the good, for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice, and the one who doesn't offer a sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who's afraid to swear. In other words, nobody's going to escape. There's one thing awaiting all of us. It's not taxes. It's death. It is the great haunt. Remember Woody Allen's line? I'm not afraid to die, he said. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Yeah. But it's appointed unto man once to die, and then comes the judgment. Hebrews 9:27. It's appointed unto man once to die, and then comes the judgment. So that's appointed to all men. Now, if you hear that, and you have this suicide watch from chapters 1 to 8, you're thinking, what's the point? But if you hear that as a believer, you say, well, we all better get to it. We all better get ready, because on the other end of death is judgment. Now, you and I who've come to believe in Yeshua have passed from judgment into eternal life. That's the good news. We are God's, that is, we belong to God. And that is awesome. That's why it's good news. Because it's appointed unto man once to die. We're all going to get there. And then those who know Messiah will be ushered into life through the portal of death. And then there are those who will be ushered into the second death, which isn't very pleasant to ponder. So we could say, if Solomon were pondering eternity like he's pondering natural things, he might be full of anxiety about second death and not first death. But it's clear that all of us, I like the description of people, isn't it? The one who swears and the one who's afraid to swear. That's kind of a funny thing. By the way, when you hear swearing, Shava, like Bathsheba, like Bathsheba, or Beersheba, the well of swearing. When you hear swearing, what do you hear? What's the word that you associate with swearing? A cuss word, which is not what it is. But vows and oaths and pledges and lawyers. Yeah, those are what I hear. But commonly, swearing is cuss words. And it's not the point of it all. Swearing is making a vow and an oath. He's saying the one who swears and the one who's afraid to swear, the one who's afraid to make an oath, because in Proverbs chapter 6, he's warned against becoming surety or a co-signer of a loan for your neighbor. He's clear on that. So there are some who don't want to do that. I'll happily help you, but I'm not going to swear. The one who sacrifices, the one who doesn't sacrifice. So a religious guy and an irreligious guy, they're all the same. Why? Because we're all going to death. He says, this is an evil, verse 3. Zerah, this is evil in all that is done under the sun, and there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and, I like this, insanity, olela, is in the hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to moot, to the dead. Madness, insanity, olela.
Dementia.
Maybe dementia. It's the end of everybody. Now, they didn't have it like we have it today, it seems. Somehow, when we read about people going mad, it was short term. Maybe we just don't know enough about what they did in the 1700s or the 1400s. There was an apparent move towards dementia by people when they lost the plot, but it didn't seem to be as endemic as it is in modern society. We seem to hear about almost everybody who gets old, and people are living longer as well. So they might have died earlier of more natural causes before they entered into a dementia state. Definitely insanity is not a pleasure. And whatever we title it, however scientific we label it, it is painful. That is to be sure. It's really hard on their own children and relatives, probably more than on anyone else, that they're not recognized in the Alzheimer's world. They're not. I think that would be the worst, among many other things. Well, there's plenty on that. So here he's saying in verses 1 to 9, that there is no way out, that everybody is going to cop this. Whoever's joined with the living, verse 4, there's hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. Why is that? Why is a live dog better than a dead lion? Even though the lion used to be the strongest animal and very accomplished, capable, but he's not as capable as a living dog. The living know they will die, but the dead don't know bupkis. They don't know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. So when you go to a Jewish funeral, you will hear about the memory of the righteous being blessed. And it's counter what Solomon is saying here. No, this one who's just died, their memory is blessed. We love that person. Let's all tell good stories about Menachem and hear what he did all his life. But the reality is people are forgotten. I drove past Rookwood the other day, and I saw all these empty spaces, and I saw all these old, old headstones. And I thought, it's unkempt right there where I was looking. Probably no one of that person's family for 180 years has been there. The memory is gone. And maybe somebody will Wikipedia that guy tomorrow, and he'll pop up on somebody's computer screen, and then it'll be gone again. Only a few in any generation are remembered in the long haul. So Nelson Mandela will be remembered. And John Kennedy, he's remembered in libraries and universities and streets. So there will be a famous person here or there. I mean, who do we know from the 11th century? Who does anyone know from the 11th century, from the 8th century? See, we know a lot now because we're in it. But who will know about us in 2,000 years? See, the memory will be forgotten. It fades away. That's right. And that's what he's saying. It is ultimate. No one can avoid it. And it's comprehensive. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished. They'll no longer have a share in all that is done, tachat hashemesh, under the sun. Nothing. There's no natural maintenance. All that they do in their love and their hate, death will consume them, and it's going to come back and bite you as well. So then, verse 7, go then, eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine with a cheerful heart. For God's already approved your works. I remember reading that one very depressed day I had back about 40 years ago. And I read that and said, I think I'll go and buy some liquor. I mean, it was the funniest thing. And I thought, no, that's not exactly what he's telling me. But it was an excuse. It was a real excuse that I was hunting as I was flipping through the Bible to find something to make me feel better. But that God had already approved my works didn't mean that he was approving everything I ever did. What it meant was that I was involved in human enterprise, and all I was going to get, tachat hashemesh, was an end that was the same as everybody. So you might as well make the best of it. And that's what I was considering. How can I make it the best? and the best was not to go get drunk, and the best was not to go eat, drink, and be merry. That was not the best. I was being informed by something better. Let your clothes be white all the time, and not let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he's given you under the sun. By the way, the word fleeting, hebel, the same word as vanity, as every other use of the word here, under the sun, which he's given you under the sun. For this is the best you're going to get. That's it. Under the sun. Obviously, the tone is, if that's all you got, make the best of it. But there's something more. I almost hear the voiceover guy on a commercial saying, but wait, there's more. That's not all there is. Whatever your hand finds to do, verse 10, do it with all your might. Sounds like what Yeshua said. Paul said that to the Ephesians. So he was informed here, do what God gives you to do with everything you've got, because you don't want to be with all your koyach, all your koach, all your strength. And you know, when you do something in Judaism, you know what you hear? Like after you have an aliyah at the shul, you shake hands with people as you come off. What do they say? Yishar koach. May your strength be returned to you. Good job, we would say, in a congratulatory way. What they're saying is, keep going. May your strength be returned and do it again. I like that. There's no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. You can only do it here, so do it. Accomplish what you're supposed to. Moshe Rosen used to say, concerning sabbaticals, it was a funny thing. I remember bringing it up to him once. He was the founder of Jews for Jesus. And I said to Moshe once, why don't we take sabbaticals? You know, all the other academic institutions, all the other mission agencies, churches do that. He said, we'll have time to rest in heaven. And I thought, well, he's got a heavenly perspective. While on earth, do it with all gusto. Verse 11, I saw again under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to the men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all.
A Christian doesn't believe in chance, does he? I spoke to a few of them, and I says, good luck, and good luck. And he says, no, not good luck, the will of God.
The Hebrew word here for chance is pega, from the word paga, meaning to meet, to reach, to approach, to attack, to cut down, entreat, happen, intercede, make supplication, strike the mark, touch, urge. So it's used all over the place, and it can be meaning...
But it's not the same as Purim.
Lots? No, not even close. Poor. No, it's more chance. It's the chance of meeting that person. You have a chance, just like you have a chance of winning lottery. If you're smart, you don't gamble, right? Because the chance of winning lottery is what? One in gazillion? Well, why should I pay for all those people who are running lottery to have their new bicycle and car and boat? I don't think so. I'll hold on to my dollars and do that. But it's a chance. We would say maybe accident, although the word pagiel is used a couple times, the occurrence of God. Man doesn't know his time, verse 12, like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. And that is a standard view of a natural man vis-a-vis death. It's wicked, or it's a terminus of, it's just not fair that kid was taken out up at, was it Byron or Coffs? At Coffs a couple weeks ago, the shark killed this beautiful 19-year-old kid. We say that just shouldn't be. I mean, maybe an 80-year-old, maybe a 90-year-old, but not a 19-year-old. Or a little kid. I've got a Facebook friend who's actually helped us here in Jews for Jesus, who's just across town in Liverpool. And she has just had a baby and it died. Not a miscarriage. She had the baby and it died. And she is in utter grief. She has three other kids, beautiful children, beautiful father and mother. I mean, they're gorgeous in so many ways. And she just can't put it together. And in the natural, what would you call it? But evil. It's wicked. It's ra. That's it. It's not right. Why is it not right? It just isn't. We don't have to even explain that. We just know it's not right. It is, because God's God over all the earth. But in the natural, that's what we say. Also this I came to see, verse 13, as wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me. The word impressed is from the word gadol. It made it big, it magnified itself to me. Ugdola, and it made itself big to me. There was a small city with a few men in it, and a great king came to it, surrounded it, constructed large siege work. Here's another autobiography moment. There was found in it a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom, yet no one remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom's better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words aren't heeded. The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. So he waxes on about death and its inevitability, its unalterability. It is comprehensive in its nature. Everyone will experience it, and then we still don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know when. So even though it's sure, it's unsure. So let's make the best of it. Well, it ends for me, this whole section about the meaninglessness, the unfair and unfulfilling nature of life. Chapter 9 concludes it, that death is the end of empty life. So where is life? And that's what we're going to talk about next week. As we finish Ecclesiastes with three chapters, we're just going to look at highlights from chapters 10, 11, and 12. The answer to all of this that we've looked at in a fairly comprehensive way, verse by verse through the book of Ecclesiastes, as we see God's answer to it all. He's hinted at it. Fear God. God's alive. God's got a plan. Wisdom is better than all that. He's hinted at it, but he's going to make it clear for anyone who's really listening. So if you've been listening to this series and you're about ready to give up, don't. Stay with me to the end, and you will find the answers that don't override the reality of natural death and natural humanity and natural living and the quest for everything, whether it was trivial pursuits or the quest to make everything good for yourself. But it is going to almost reshape us into the people who need to be thinking about deeper, bigger, longer thoughts than self-appreciation and self-fulfillment. We need to find what God wants for not just me, but for our world in which we are.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.